Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:04. It is Friday, March 24, 2017. Before we begin, I want to thank Christy Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary. She makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Alex from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Ledoux, my Vice Chair, Representative Fansler, myself, Representative Klayman, Representative Reinbold is, I think, on the line. Can you hear us, Representative Reinbold?
She did say she is on the line.
Representative Reinbold, can you hear us? Well, I'm confident she will in due course get online. I also note that Representative Kopp is excused today. And I want to note that Representative Sponholz is here in the room and joined us. Representative Sponholz, just so you know, your bill is up third, and to the extent you don't want to listen to everything that we do in judiciary, we won't think ill of you if you decide to take a short break before we begin with your bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Can you hear us now, Representative Reinbold?
Yes, I will have you on mute, but I have been on for a little bit here. So.
Oh, okay, because we kept asking for you, and we never heard anything, but... Just if we won't ask you, but if you want to be heard, make sure you speak up so I know you want an opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We do have a quorum to do business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 69, Repeal Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the Governor. Since our last meeting, my office received the white paper that was prepared by the Office of Administrative Hearings during the prior governor's administration. That white paper has been distributed, and members should have had an opportunity to review that copy. Marie Marks of the Division of Workers' Compensation is here. It's more on a question basis. If anyone has questions about the white paper, then I'll have Ms. Marks come up and she can answer your questions. But if there are no questions about the white paper, then we don't need to make Ms. Marks come forward. And I don't see anyone with questions. Okay. That brings the bill back, House Bill 69, before the committee. Is there any further discussion? Hearing and seeing none, any final comments, discussion or comments, or all of the above?
So what is the intention of the chair then to pass this bill out shortly, and curious if there's any decisions to be made other than voting on the bill itself? Has the white paper inspired any thoughts?
Does anyone, Representative Ledoux, some questions?
My reading of the white paper is it seemed to be a discussion of physically moving the place where the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission was. It seemed to be more about, you know, its physical location than any substantive changes in the procedures. So, you know, I was glad to get the white paper because when somebody mentions a paper like that, you kind of think, oh, wow, there's going to be something really interesting in it. And it turned out that it really, in my opinion, really didn't have much to do with anything.
Do you have any thoughts about the white paper, Representative?
Oh, I thought it was very interesting that, especially the discussion of saving every single piece of paper since the inception and still not having a full file room. Yes, more about the space. Now, was there going to be any more testimony?
The public hearing is closed, and so unless there's questions, I know Commissioner Dragas is here. If somebody has questions, we certainly can. And Marie Marks is obviously here, so if you have questions, we can certainly raise those questions. I thought most of that we had a pretty extensive discussion when this was last before us. I will note as committee chair, my read on the white paper was kind of a housing question about where we're going to put the folks. And I think the question that this bill raises is the existing structure working? And we have, four public members who are volunteers and one lawyer that sits as the chair of the commission. And it sure seems like public members are sort of kind of there's no polite way to say it, a little on the fringes of the process, and it seems like they've had a lot of turnover in the commission chair, and so and this is a significant savings because there's no fiscal note related to it from the court system. So whereas the white paper was kind of, one could say, save a little rent, maybe a little more efficient use of space, this is a significant change in the cost structure. Mm-hmm. That wasn't, the white paper didn't really propose a, I guess it would have saved some, but it nowhere near the same as we're looking at with this proposal. But go ahead, Representative.
Well, my boilerplate thoughts for what they are is, you know, it seems like there's been quite a history with the commission, or rather the issue which the commission has been trying to take up. And, you know, we tried it in the courts with, you know, obviously enough consternation on all parties to move it to the commission. And now there seems to be a similar amount of consternation at the commission level. So I am open to the idea of trying something new. Certainly we always have the option of putting them back in the courts, but it seems like we've already tried that and it didn't go so well, and I haven't heard of anything that would be different or new about that arrangement that would lead us to expect a better resolution than we had the first time.
Well, that's a perspective. All right, Representative Ledoux.
So I actually was here in this building when they transferred it from the courts to the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. And I never really thought that anybody had presented any compelling evidence that there was a problem with the courts and that it needed to go to the Workers' Compensation, that this new Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission needed to be created. And I've ultimately come down on the side of, okay, just about everything else goes from an administrative hearing to the Superior Court. And so why should workers' compensation cases be treated any differently than that? And then the second thought is that the Office of Hearing, the Office of Administrative Appeals, I think, is the formal name of it. I mean, there was going to be a fiscal note with that. They didn't commit that they would not need extra staff for it. So as far as I'm concerned, let it go back to the courts.
I don't see any other discussion. I have a motion.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move version 30-GH1773/O of committee substitute for House Bill 69 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
And I don't see any objections, so House Bill 69 will move from the committee, and as we go forward, the paper will make its way around our committee, and if you can sign that. Our second order of business today is House Bill 108, Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee, and as I am the sponsor of this bill, I'm going to pass the gavel to my Vice Chair, Representative Fansler, for the duration of our hearing on House Bill 108.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, our second order of business is House Bill 108. There is a proposed committee substitute to House Bill 108. May I have a motion to adopt the committee substitute as our working document?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the House Judiciary Committee adopt the committee substitute to House Bill 108, version 30-LS0210/U, as our working document.
Are there any objections? All right, hearing none, the committee adopts the committee substitute. Here to introduce the bill is Representative Klayman and Deborah Baer. a member of the Alaska Uniform Law Delegation. Would the bill sponsor and bill presenter please come forward and identify themselves for the record, and then you may begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Matt Klayman, Alaska State Representative for House District 21 in West Anchorage. I would like to thank you all for hearing this piece of legislation today. House Bill 108 updates Alaska statutes to expand the legal authority of fiduciaries to access digital assets. In 2015, 74,000 Alaskans, 9.9% of Alaska's population, were over the age of 65. With an increasingly computer-savvy senior population, fiduciary access to digital assets is more important than ever. House Bill 108 gives fiduciaries the legal authority to manage assets such as computer files, digital photographs, or electronic communications. And with that, I will turn it over to Deborah Baer of the Uniform Law Commission to explain the bill to you.
Good afternoon. I'm Deborah Baer, and I'm a Uniform Law Delegation member from the state of Alaska. Alaska has been a member of the Uniform Law Delegation since about 1914. And the Uniform Law Commission is what I consider to be a state's rights organization. Each state sends their representative to meet annually to deal with problems that cross state lines, like commerce, like digital assets. And we come up with a solution after great negotiations that works for all the states. And this bill is the result of that in terms of digital assets. 24 states have already enacted it. It is a law in 24 states, and it's presently pending on 18 states, of which of those 18 states, two are sitting on governor's desks. So this is an actively moving bill, and it has been generally accepted in other states. And the Uniform Law Commissioners have reviewed the Alaska delegation, have reviewed the CS, and we do support the CS and the changes to it. What I thought I'd do is give an overview of the bill and then ask if you folks have any questions. The act itself was the result of senior groups coming to the Uniform Law Commission and saying that they had difficulties when a family member died, and the fiduciary, in typical cases, a husband and wife, the wife is the fiduciary. She's the one that the husband trusted to deal with his assets when he passed on. And there's a problem in digital assets right now. The law has not kept pace with digital assets, such that in a typical case, the husband, an example of digital assets, is like the family photo album. In my house, my husband takes all the family photos, puts them on some cloud or some server that I don't quite understand, and has their password protected or encrypted so that the average person can't get to his photos. He has also signed a contract with the custodian of those photos, and in that contract they agree to keep them confidential. People can't generally have access to it, and that's generally where the problem is with digital assets and why they're different than your deed, your house, your car, or whatever will transfer at your death, because they're password protected, and there's also been a contract promise between, in my case, it would be my husband that passed away, there would be a contract promise between the custodian, Google, Facebook, whatever, to keep my husband's documents on file with them confidential. So we received cases from all over the United States about people wanting to get even the most basic thing like the family photo album. And when they would go to Google or Facebook for it, and they'd say, geez, we'd really like to help you, but your husband, the decedent, the user, when he signed the terms of service agreement with Google or Facebook, he asked for us to keep it confidential. That's our standard form, and we're stuck with that. Please get a court order. Court orders are expensive to get, and there's a delay in getting them, and it's also at a time for families when it's very stressful for them. There's been a death in the family, there's been a disability in the family, and it just takes time. And in some cases, that's time has actual money costs to the family. One example that someone gave me was where someone had became disabled, and he was a sole proprietor of a business. He had all his business records in the cloud, paperless, in his office, and somebody had to come and run his business while he recuperated. Well, the problem is the husband at that point did not have capacity to say what his passwords were, or even where they were, where the digital assets were located. So it ended up being a big mess for the family. The family defaulted on loans. They had to pay extra interest that they wouldn't have to deal with. And so that's the, those are the kinds of problems that came to the Uniform Law Commission. Why we thought a uniform law was important across state lines, because first of all, digital commerce goes across state lines. We don't have any choice in that. And also, the residents of Alaska travel a lot. And so you want to make sure that their expectations are followed. And then the bill basically says that you look at the residency of where the user, in this case my deceased husband, would be, what kind of law would apply. And you didn't really look at this. And so in this case, it would be Alaska law apply. So what is the solution that the Uniform Law Commissioners came up with? And this is a result of a two-year public process. It's open public. Anybody can come to our meetings. Google, Facebook, the industry was there. Senior groups were there. And just anybody who cared to. And after the end of a two-year process, it came up with what I call an opt-in system, so that the decedent, the person, when they're alive, has to say to Google or Facebook, this is how I would like my digital assets handled. And it's called an online tool. That's the buzzword for it. So Google or Facebook will have an online tool so that when you open the account, it will come up as a separate electronic document that you will decide whether you want to use it or not. You don't have to. There's no requirement that you do. And if you do use it, then that sets the clear path for the family photos to go to whoever the decedent had wanted at the time that he opened the account with Google or Facebook. And you can change it readily. And the nice thing about it, people have asked me about it, you don't need a lawyer to do the online tool. You can have a different person who has access to your family photos or your music, whatever makes sense. Like in, your financial records, you may not want your children to have access to them. You may want your brother, who's a CPA, to do them if you passed away. But your music or the family photos, children, something like that might be just fine. So it's an opt-in system. Person does nothing. They can't take the benefits of the online tool, but the online tool is available for them. Okay, what happens if there is no online tool, or the person just decides not to use it, or in the case of probably all of us in this room, we have opened digital accounts years ago, and this tool wasn't available. Okay, so the tool isn't available. You go on to what is called you look at the person's will. And this bill also covers trusts, powers of attorneys, guardianship, and conservatorship. But I'm going to focus on wills because it's easier to understand. If it is very clear in the will who you want your digital assets to go to, then the bill sets a priority system for that. The issue that came up in when we were dealing with this is most wills are the typical, I give all my assets to my wife, or I give all my assets to my husband. And that generally causes a problem because you don't know whether it's digital assets, and you also have this contract that your husband signed or your wife signed saying that they would like to have the digital assets treated in a confidential manner. So if it's clear enough in the will that you can see it, that the digital assets were intended, and there's an express consent in there, I want my fiduciary, my wife, or whoever to get access to them, then that's the trigger. That's the second level of the online system. The third level, supposing that you have no online tool, wasn't available, or you just didn't, you were in a hurry and buzzed through that screen on it, your will is a general will, or a lot of Alaskans have no wills. So you have no will. What happens next? It's the terms of service agreement apply. And that's the terms of service agreement that my husband signed with Google or Facebook. They are generally going to mean you've got a court case out of it, because in the terms of service agreement, they're generally, you are going to keep this confidential, and so you're basically stuck with a court case on it. So, but if somebody chooses to do nothing, and doesn't do an online tool, their will doesn't address it, then you will look at the terms of service agreement. This system has been supported by industry. Google, Facebook have, technical groups have supported it. Senior groups nationwide, ARP, National Academy of Elder Attorneys have supported it. In Alaska, we're very pleased that the Alaska ARP has supported it. Major trust company in Alaska has said, yes, this is a problem in Alaska, and they support it. And Alaska Commission on Aging. You will see those endorsement letters in this file. There is the other interplay with digital assets. Is there a federal law on this issue dealing with electronic communications and how you store them, and that they have to be confidential? So the bill sets up a system for a special treatment for email, because I think everybody in this room, when you write an email, you don't think people are going to be reading over your shoulder and looking at how you're doing it and all that. So how the bill sets up a structure for email is, if you give consent, express consent, my fiduciary, my wife, can have access to the email, no question, you can get it under the bill. The other option is a court order, which, because courts right now can monitor that when it's appropriate. If the person has not done an express consent and there's no court order, then the best that the fiduciary gets is under this bill is what is called the Catalog of Electronic Communications. And what that sets up is just the to, from, and the date and the addresses on it, not the subject line, not the body of it, because the person did not express during his or her lifetime that they would want their electronic communications viewed by a third party, even a spouse. And that's absolutely appropriate. The fiduciaries in this area have said they can do a lot with the name and the email address. They can go and if you see 10 emails from Wells Fargo and the banks, they pretty much have a good idea you have some financial relationship with Wells Fargo, and they can go forward and deal with them. And a big issue that I've done some research recently on is closing accounts. There's a whole lot of fraud in this area when somebody leaves a digital account open after someone dies. People will go in and open credit cards on it. They will send out flyers saying, I'm ill and I need contributions for my medical care. You really need to close these accounts. And this will allow you to identify the accounts and go forward with it. Anybody have any questions at this point before I go a little farther? Okay, it does not,
Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, Ms. Baer. We did have a question from Representative Ledoux.
Here.
Okay, so you keep saying, pictures, but then you also say Facebook. So is this going to let somebody into your Facebook account, just your regular Facebook account?
If you do the online tool and you say, like Facebook right now, after their negotiations on this, Facebook has what is called a legacy form right now. So if you go in and open a Facebook account today, my understanding is that you can say, if I pass away, this is the person can have access to my private part of Facebook. Facebook, I'm not an expert in electronics, so I can get way ahead of myself easily. But my understanding is there's a public part of it where anybody can look at it, and then there's a private part of it where you have to friend people and people have to come into it. That's the part that this bill deals with. It also deals with email communications. So the definition of digital asset is pretty broad, and it can include things that have a value, like domain names. I'm told they have some value. Bitcoins, electronic currency. So it's a big issue nationwide, and it's a big issue that affects seniors.
Follow-up, Representative Ledoux. Oh, and I'd also like to recognize that Representative Christ Tompkins has joined us.
I'm fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Baer? Okay, if you want to continue on. Okay. Thank you.
All right. I'm got everybody up to date. Okay, what happens if I'm a...
Sorry, not to interrupt.
I just thought of something.
Good. Representative Ledoux.
So is Facebook amenable when people have already... I mean, I opened a Facebook account forever ago. Right. Of sending out people who already have the accounts notice and a link to something that they can then... fill out this legacy form on if they want to?
Okay. Through the chair, I don't represent Google or Facebook, and I honestly don't want to speak for these businesses what they can and cannot do. But I do know it is there, and I do know people have been using it now that they and going back and attaching it to it. The subset of your question, which I think is people have asked me, what about training? And I have heard from the senior groups that they are actively going to be doing education in this area. I have talked to the Bar Association's Committee on Probate and Probate Section, and they're very interested in making sure that everybody's aware of it. And if you go and Google this topic on regular Google, there's a tremendous amount of material out there on it. It's just I don't think it's trickled up in Alaska that much. But it is an issue because we do have a major trust company in Alaska that has said it's a real issue for them.
Thank you.
Sure. Any other? Okay. What happens if I'm a fiduciary and the decedent, my husband, whatever, has said yes, you may have access. All the duties and responsibilities that a fiduciary has, such as like protecting information. Checking on copyrights, things like that. They have the same responsibilities that you have for other assets that are in the estate. And the bill sets up what kinds of things that they have to give to the Google or Facebook to get the information. And it's usually things like a certified death certificate, things like that. The bill does provide immunity for Google or Facebook if they do it right according to the bill, and if they respond appropriately within 60 days. And that's a big deal because right now this can languish on for long periods of time while Google is checking with the attorney or you're getting a court order. There's no real parameters of trying to get things out. This puts a limit of 60 days to make sure that things are done appropriately according to the bill. Okay, the bill does not apply to digital assets of employers. So, like, there's a lot of private employers that pretty much allow people to use the business computer for their own use. It does not. This bill does not deal with that. That's separate and apart. Section 1 of the CS and how it differs from the base bill amends the Alaska statutory form of power of attorney bill to allow people, if they use the canned statutory form of power of attorney, that they can specifically give consent for access to electronic documents. And that was sort of brought to my attention when I testified last time that there was an amendment that needed to be done there, and that's appropriate. I appreciate the time, and I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Are there any questions from the committee at this time?
Just one.
Representative Clayman.
Just so that I'm following, one example you have is Facebook photos, and another you talk about is emails, and it sounds like the bill actually specifically distinguishes those two, so somebody might be very comfortable giving somebody complete access to, say, their Facebook account, mm-hmm. and I recognize that some people think Facebook is sort of private and some have a different perspective on it, that it isn't so private, and they might say, sure, you can have full access to Facebook, but treat emails differently, and then emails might be set up so all that people would have access to is the data, the communication, and the it was going to or coming from, and that's this allows that distinction to be made.
Yeah, the bill that was one of the big strong questions of privacy groups to make sure that people's expectation generally that the content of their email is confidential, so that and also federal law the content of email, it has special privacy rights, and that's why then it requires an express consent to get at the content or a court order.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Now, I understand the commission decided that a bill was appropriate in this instance. I'm wondering, why would this not normally be handled simply by encouraging those who write wills and encouraging those who develop templates for wills to make sure that this was addressed in that will somewhere?
Excellent question. The problem is, if you look right now, you still have the problem with Google or Facebook. I'll use my example of my husband, who's nice and healthy, I thank you, but if he were to be deceased, he signed a contract with a third party that I have no relations to and said, please keep my information confidential. I'm giving you my information so it won't appear in the Anchorage newspaper or whatever, and it's here. That is the overlay that makes this different than any other, like your house, your car, or whatever. Also, my husband's photos or whatever are password protected, might even be encrypted. The business records might be encrypted. And so just putting it in a will is not going to deal with this major issue of what you do with the private contract that I, as the fiduciary, the spouse, was not even a party to. Why should Google give me access to an account that they don't even know whether my husband and I are still living together or have any relationship with each other anymore, even though we're still married? So it just is to deal with this unique issue, and that's why digital assets are different. So that's an excellent question. That's been asked a couple of times from me.
Follow-up, Representative Eastman.
Yes, also through the chair. Now, does the commission distinguish between emails and photos on the one hand and digital asset passwords on the other hand? Because it would seem, certainly if my spouse were to die or vice versa, it's really the passwords that would be the most sought after. Passwords to bank accounts, passwords to, any number of different things. And those, of course, would be part of the digital assets, but they don't necessarily fall in, under Facebook or anything like that. They're just, it's electronic information saved somewhere.
Through the chair, passwords are a particularly interesting and difficult issue, and that's why I'm glad you ask it. Passwords are generally linked with a particular account, like your bank account, your Facebook, your whatever. And to get access to that, you have to know the password. The problem with passwords is I've had people say, well, why can't we just exchange pieces of paper with passwords on them? The problem is that passwords change. People have accounts that they don't necessarily even for themselves remember their password to it, or their old accounts. And so you have to be able to provide a system in that situation where, like my example where the private business person, sole proprietor, had a stroke, young person, has a stroke, doesn't have any, doesn't know where their accounts are anymore, doesn't know what their passwords are. You have to be able to go directly into the accounts and be able to have a relationship with Google, Facebook, whoever has the electronic assets. And the bill allows several ways for you to get the documents. You can get limited to what your focus is, and that could be in the case of a guardianship, that they are very limited to financial records, or conservatorship. It could be limited to that focus. The bill sets up a system to deal with that because passwords change. Also, you don't want to have a booklet sitting around with passwords on it. Someone takes them, they've got your whole financial records that they could go and modify and change and hack in.
Any follow-up there, Representative Eastman? Okay. And Representative Reinbold would like to ask a question. Representative Reinbold.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. So first of all, I think this is a very interesting bill. It's a new topic and an interesting topic, so thank you for bringing it forward. What my question has to do is, does this have any impact, let's say, on our legislative Facebook account, or how would this have impacted the situation, for example, of Representative Grunberg?
I'm sorry, through the chair. I don't know the situation with Representative Grunberg.
Maybe Mr. Representative Klayman could discuss the situation. I know that they didn't have the ability to access some of his important legislative work and items in his office. And I'm not sure if this bill was spawned on because of that or from a completely different angle, but maybe Representative Clayman can.
I can answer a couple of those questions, and others I probably can't. It's with respect to Representative Grunberg and Facebook. My general sense is that Representative Grunberg, for whom we've named this room, He liked books and he liked papers and he liked the old style way of doing things. And if he had a Facebook account, none of us ever saw it. And Representative Ledoux, I think, is laughing. I suspect she's laughing because it's hard to imagine Representative Grunberg having a Facebook account. So I suspect that in that world, it doesn't have much impact. And then I think there were issues involving both his actual papers and who had custody of the papers, and then to the extent there were email communications, which again, I think those were probably emails and communications that were undertaken more by his staff than Representative Grunberg, because again, I think he tended to be a person with pen and paper, I'm not sure was a touch typist. And so I'm not quite sure how these would fit into that, but in terms of the motivation for the bill, as the person that sponsored this bill, I can assure you that Representative Grunberg's recent death had absolutely nothing to do that. The Uniform Laws Commission came to me as judiciary chair and asked me to introduce this bill because of the increasing need on a national level to address these issues. And as somebody that is fairly familiar with the uniform laws process and the ways in which states individually elect to join in or not join in with a particular uniform law, this seemed like a very good bill to bring forward because of the issues that it raises. I would also note, just in response to some of the questions Representative Eastman raised, and Ms. Baer, you should chime in if I don't get this right, but in terms of the privacy questions, I think that in kind of the world of an estate setting or a severely disabled person who can no longer manage their things, I tend to think that the courts would view access to the financial information that you would get from Wells Fargo with that password would be a very important thing to let the estate kind of, what are their assets, how much money is there, what other assets do they have that you would need to manage, either in the estate context or a disabled person's context. And access to that would be actually quite important, whereas I would tend to think that email communications, well, we all like to think that our email communications are the stuff that will make a great novel. I think the privacy concerns respecting those kinds of communications kind of enters into a very different realm in terms of where does privacy come in, because I think, you know, my executors would very much have an interest in knowing how where the money was. But I tend to think that if I wanted to tell the folks that, sorry, but they couldn't really go back and read my old emails, as much as some might think those were interesting, that seems to me a very, very different privacy interest that gets raised. And then the only other thing I would note, and then I'll let others chime in, one of the issues that this raises, in an ideal world, the overwhelming majority, if not everyone, has wills. But I think the reality is quite far from that. I will candidly confess, as an attorney who's married to an attorney, I think we were married more than 10 years before we managed to get a will together. And we both knew that we needed one. And so part of what this does is it makes it easier in instance of an intestacy. It creates ways for family members to actually try to figure that out. And it also creates the contractual a forum for the contractual relationship between places like Facebook and email carriers to be able to deal with those things without a will setting out what to do. But those are just a few of my comments as bill sponsor. And if I've missed anything, Ms. Baer, you should.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Yes,
sorry.
Representative Reinbold, you still have the floor, so to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do appreciate it. So, Representative Klayman, I would just like to ask in a different way. Would this have any impact at all in someone's work account? For example, I know I have a Representative Reinbold Facebook account. Would this have any impact on anything that happens in a place of work?
you know, this has nothing to do with Bloomberg. It was just an example. I just wanted to make sure that I've had several people ask me if this was going to impact anything having to do with a place work or a public office.
So, Representative Reinbold, through the chair, I will take a run at this, but I may get corrected. I believe that your Facebook account reflects a relationship between you and Facebook. Even though you have that relationship in your representative capacity, your Facebook account is not formally part of what the Legislative Affairs Agency manages. And so that becomes a relationship between you, the individual who happens to be a representative, and I have one of those same Facebook accounts, and Facebook, whereas your email communications in your Rep. Laura Reinbold account, which is really managed by Legislative Affairs, then you get into the whole more complicated question about public officials and public records and who controls those, and I'm not even going to go there. I hope that answers your question.
Sort of, kind of, maybe Deb there can answer the long-standing relationship with her as former regulatory review chair.
Okay. Representative Reinbold, Representative Ledoux is furiously trying to get my attention, so perhaps she has something to say.
I just wanted to.
Oh.
When Representative Reinbold is finished with her line of questions.
Okay.
I'm good, Representative. Yield the floor.
Ms. Baer, did you have anything you wanted to follow up on top of what Representative Klayman offered?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you then, Representative Reinbold, for your query, and we will go next to Representative Ledoux.
So I was just wondering, when we talk about digital bank account information, there's really nothing in that digital bank account information that's not available, you know, just that the bank's got the information. I mean, there's nothing that you really need actually a password so much for, but I think there must be a procedure when somebody dies and you are the executor of their estate. You go to the bank and the bank gives you the information. I mean, the digital account is just kind of, it's there, and you want to check whether a check's cleared and you look at your app.
Through the chair, this is a very interesting question, and it's especially, I noticed with younger attorneys at the Department of Law, they're moving their private personal financial accounts to be totally paperless. So if you have a totally paperless account and your executor has no idea where that totally paperless account is, how are they going to find it? In this bill right now, you can get a catalog of communications, and you can see, like my husband just got something from Wells Fargo saying that his tax return form was available. Well, you see the to from, you'll see the date, it's around tax time, and you have a pretty good idea that there's some financial relationship with Wells Fargo, even if you didn't know where he banked. Now, it's probably not a good example of the husband and wife, but I could easily be the executor of my brother's will in North Carolina. I don't have a clue where my brother banks. And I might need to have access to, I would have to know where his assets are. And that's why these trust companies are nationwide, and one in Alaska, are saying this is a good idea, because you have to be able to gather information where the assets are. This bill does not transfer those assets. You still have to go to Wells Fargo and fill out their paperwork and do it according to the banking laws and the stockbroking laws and all this. It just helps you as a way to locate assets you didn't know were available.
Follow up, Representative Ledoux.
So, I mean, I like the idea for this law, so I'm not trying to give you a hard time here, but it would seem to me that if I was the executor of my brother's estate and I didn't know where he banked because everything was totally paperless, well, if I had any relationship with my brother, I'd probably know where he worked. So from where he worked, you could find out actually where they are depositing his checks.
Through the chair, that's definitely a possibility, but there's also people who don't have a strong relationship with an employer, or they're self-employed. And it's just, it covers a multitude of situations. And so the bill's trying to address the electronic age, and it's trying to bring the law into conformity with where the world is moving. The world is moving to paperless, whether we like it or not. And I know some of my accounts are pretty much, they're pushing me towards paperless. And that's the way it's going to go. And so it's going to be more and more difficult to find out where assets are that a fiduciary and executor has a duty to gather, monitor, pay out, pay bills. And look at the delay that it would take. Like, to give an example of my brother. If he had a mortgage payment or something like that, and I had no idea where he banked, I'd have to go call in all the banks in the area where he lives. He's lucky he lives in a small town. But if he lived in Washington, D.C. or something, that's a lot of banks to call or to send documents to.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, the Chair. How has the Commission looked upon instances where a third party might have an interest in whether or not certain records are disclosed? For example, you know, I specify in my will that I want, you know, all of my digital assets available to my wife, but then, you know, I work for the legislature, and there's confidentiality expectations with regard to communications, which in all likelihood might, you know, be part of those records. Or I work for the Army, or whoever I work for, and my employer has an interest or thinks they have an interest in not having, you know, access to my wife to have those kind of records.
Excellent question. This does not change other law. So as I'm a fiduciary and I have to copyright is the one that, you know, if I get an asset that's copyrighted, I can't go and blast it all over the newspaper. I got to follow copyright law. If I get something that's confidential, like I'm trying to get a death benefit for my husband's estate and I've learned confidential medical records, I have to treat those confidential. Just the way he would do it. But it doesn't change other laws. So that's an excellent question. And it doesn't change how I have to get military benefits or how I have to go to somebody's banking account. This doesn't change that law. I still have to conform to the law that the legislature has adopted in banking, stocks, military benefits, or whatever.
Any other questions from the committee? I will take an indulgence if not. Ask a couple of questions that I was asking of thinking about. The first one I have has to do with industry buy-in. You mentioned Google and Facebook were very supportive of this. I'll out myself and admit I still have a Hotmail account. Is this universal buy-in? Or are we seeing Microsoft and Yahoo and kind of 100% buy-in? Or are there some companies out there that were not on board with this?
Excellent question. First of all, this bill would not have passed in 23 or 24 states, depending on two governors' desks, if people had serious problems with it. They didn't think it was going to work. And I don't look at somebody opposing it. It wouldn't work for their business. And so it's passed in all these states for that reason. It's been an open public process. Anybody who wants to come can come. I asked specifically at the national office if they had any complaints, if they had heard any complaints or any serious opposition to this, and I was told no.
The second question I had, was there any thought given, since there was work with the industry, to seeing if there could be a situation where the industry was willing to change, you know, the user license agreements or their terms for their sites? I mean, I go on to CNN pretty frequently, and I think like every other day they have a new agreement that pops up that says they've changed. That might be a way to assure everyone that they have to do this without having to go and now maybe change your will that you might have in place.
Okay, you're asking a very sophisticated question. First of all, this also, Google and Facebook will tell you if they were here that they're following federal law. Federal law has certain privacy restrictions on communications, electronic communications. So even if you change the user agreement, you still have this problem with federal law requiring that it be confidential and that you have the consent of the person before you get into the content of their electronic communications. The nice thing about the online tool, it allows industry to develop what kind of online tool they want for their business. And so I can imagine that Facebook has something very, very different than Wells Fargo would, because the need's different. And I've heard some wonderful things that Facebook is doing on setting up legacy pages, so you can explain, your loved one passed away, and this is where the service is, and this is where you can send donations and that sort of thing. But it wouldn't have passed in 24 states if there were serious problems with it, and it has passed and is law in 24 states.
And my final question then also relates to, and this is once again more on the industry end, but these opt-in systems that you spoke to, are they generally blanket opt-ins? We spoke kind of Google. Google has Google Gmail, and then you also get Google Drive, and you get the calendar, and you get all the different suites. Is it like an opt-in by one, or is it a general you opt in and everything goes over?
Through the chair, I really don't have the expertise to answer that question. And the bill sets up them to do an online tool. I don't know whether Google has one for each one. It's possible that they do, because then maybe the needs are different. I can imagine, but I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't want to guess.
And finally, very similarly with Facebook is a blending almost of pictures and media that might be very valuable. But you also do have your Facebook Messenger, where that's much more like an email chat system. Mm-hmm. Does this bill allow you to delineate between those two? So, for instance, if I want my future spouse to have access to all my pictures, but there's something that I don't want to have her have access to the messenger part of it?
Well, the protections for the content of electronic communications, in my opinion, apply even if it was a blended account. You still have to show consent, because you have to get around federal law that says consent. And consent, I was looking at some of the standard forms of consent. It's not something somebody easily gives. I mean, it's like the kinds you'd give for your doctors to give out your medical records. It's a large couple of sentences explaining, so the person knows what they're doing and what access they're giving up. But you don't need consent. You don't need that level of signed consent for photos and things like that. A more general consent would be fine.
So, just to follow up with that, so are you saying that there would be, so Facebook would require the more advanced consent because they have, I mean, they do have the pictures that need the general, but they definitely have the messenger portion to there.
I don't advise Google or Facebook, but I can tell them they need to look at federal law, and federal law requires a pretty good consent on giving out contents of electronic communications.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? All right. Excellent. With no further questions, I am now going to open public testimony for House Bill 108. And right now it appears we have Ken Hellander from Anchorage at the Anchorage LIO. Ken, are you with us online?
Yes, I am.
Ken, can you state your name and your affiliation for the record, and then begin your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ken Hellander. I'm the Advocacy Director at AARP Alaska. This has been very interesting listening to the conversation and the questions. I think it underscores that this proposed legislation is the consequence of our digital age and the increasing role that it plays in our everyday lives. We've sort of long accepted the legally defined roles of conservator, executor, agent in carrying out these fiduciary duties with respect to tangible assets on behalf of a deceased individual or a person that's incapacitated and unable to make decisions. But the many accounts an average person now opens and uses digitally for commerce, banking, entertainment, research, social networking, These are all complex and protected by each account's rules of privacy. I know we all read the fine print on those terms of service agreements, but nevertheless, it can be confusing. I thought, it'd be helpful to give examples of what digital assets are, and when you start thinking about it, it really is so much a part of our daily lives. Financial accounts that go beyond banking to a brokerage, an online brokerage, to how you pay your bills. Virtual property accounts like virtual currencies, now like Bitcoin. Or even something that's really important to us in Alaska, how about your air miles? If you have online business accounts at eBay or Amazon or Etsy, email accounts from Gmail and Outlook and Yahoo, social networking accounts from Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and on, online storage accounts, Google Drive, iCloud, Dropbox, application accounts like Netflix, Kindle, and Apple TV, websites and blogs and videos like YouTube and WordPress, and I'm sure that the list can go on and will continue to grow. But these are, each of these different types of services have their own terms of service agreements, which is, as Deborah Baer said, a contract. And because of that, companies are reluctant to share the information when they promise not to. And it's been no less murky even in the event of a person's death. The importance of being able to close accounts and avoid unnecessary expenses and prevent often unauthorized account use or identity theft really does require new approaches to manage these affairs. So in short, the bill's provision would give Alaskans the right to treat their digital assets in the same manner that they treat their tangible assets. And we really do view this as another way that individuals are able to do effective advanced life planning and to give trusted family members the ability to settle the loved one's financial and personal affairs. And we support the passage of this bill by your committee and by the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hellander. Is there any questions from the committee? All right. Seeing none, we thank you for your testimony. I see no one else online scheduled to testify. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify regarding House Bill 108? Seeing no one, we will close public testimony at this time. Are there any further questions from the committee? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My only question at this point is, are there any deviations between the bill in front of us and what the commission has recommended for those other states?
I know Deborah Baer will come up. I will note one. It's not really the commission recommendation, but we realized in the course of drafting that last year we had changed the statutory form power of attorney that's in our statutes, and we realized that we needed to add a subsection into our form that included those. So if you see Section 1 of the bill, that's the modification to the statutory form power of attorney. If you look on page 3, that's the provisions that address this particular bill. And the rest of the question, Ms. Baer is better adept to answer than I am.
For the record, Deborah Baer, and I'm Alaska Uniform Law Delegation. Your question is a good one because it's really important in the uniform law area that our bill be comparable to what other states do. And I can tell you, I ran the base bill through the Chicago office of the Uniform Law Commission. They said it was just fine. It's got little style changes that are different for Alaska, like our definitions are at the end of the bill, where in the uniform law they're at the front of the bill, but it's substantively doesn't change anything. So that's an excellent question. The base bill is fine. The amendment for our Alaska specific power of attorney form, the Uniform Law Commission would have no comment on that because that's not a uniform form or a uniform that's used in other states.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee at this time? Okay. Seeing none, we are going to hold House Bill 108 at this time for further review. So I will now hand the gavel back over to Chairman Klingman.
Thank you, Representative Fansler. Our final order of business today is House Bill 123, Disclosure of Healthcare Costs, sponsored by the patient, Representative Sponholz. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee, and here to introduce the bill is Representative Sponholz. If the bill sponsor and her staff would please identify themselves for the record, and then you may begin your presentation.
Hello, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Ivy Sponholz, representing District 16 in East Anchorage. And with me is Bernice Nisbet, who is my aide working on this bill. HB 123, Price Transparency and Healthcare Costs, is about providing power to consumers. Sir Francis Bacon, who's the father of the scientific methods, acknowledges power. I think we all know this to be true in our everyday lives, but healthcare is the only market in which we as consumers don't know the price before we have the before we consider buying it or we actually use the services. This removes one of the most fundamental tenets of capitalism, that is the power of the consumer to make choices about what they do or what they don't purchase. While HB 123 isn't the silver bullet we would all like to see solve the problems of outrageous inflationary prices and health care costs, it does put consumers back where they belong, and that's in the driver's seat, by ensuring that they have more information as they consider making medical purchases. An example that that I often think of is, a situation that many of us have been in, and that is, the parent who went to our kids' Tuesday night soccer game, and there was a head-on collision between 2 8-year-olds, and your child, your son or your daughter may have, bonked their head, and as a conscientious parent, you may take them to the ER if you're concerned, or the pediatrician if you're concerned that they may have a concussion. The doctor at this time can do a fairly rudimentary physical examination and make recommendations as to the next course of action without further information. However, sometimes they may even, despite further evidence, recommend to you that you consider a very expensive MRI, an MRI which could cost $2,400 but might not actually change the outcome of their recommendations to you. It's our theory that if consumers had that information, they might actually ask the question, well, would that change your diagnosis? Would it change the treatment? Do you need that MRI in order to properly diagnose my patient, my child? What we've done in HB 123 is, in a manner that is as simple and cost-effective to implement as possible, is to try to make sure that consumers have that kind of information, that they have that information in the reception area of the doctor's office that they go to or the emergency room, that they can also look that information up online, and that that same information is sent in to the Department of Health and Social Services. We've done it in a way that we think reduces the amount of burden to providers. We understand that medical providers already have a lot of onerous burdens required of them in the medical billing system, which is notorious for having about 10,000 different billing codes. But what this bill would do is simply require that they run a report of the 25, if they're an individual provider, or 50, if they're a larger facility, most commonly offered procedures in the previous calendar year, turn that into a PDF, put it on the wall in their reception area, put it on their website, which any of us can do pretty simply, and then send it in an email to the department. But the department would simply put it on their website. This will give people a lot more information as consumers. In the last committee in which this bill was heard, there was a little bit of concern that some consumers might be turned off by the price that is being proposed in this bill to be listed, and that is what are we calling it?
The undiscounted price.
Thank you, which is the price before any preferred provider discounts are offered before any other discounts or individual arrangements are provided. And so we amended the bill to include the opportunity for a disclaimer. This was very important for community health providers who wanted to hear that that they could describe that you wouldn't necessarily pay the price that was being listed because they have a sliding fee scale according to your income. This also gives individual providers the opportunity to indicate that they are a preferred provider with individual health insurance plans, and once again to refer patients to the doctor or to the billing office for further information. So I hope that we've been able to address that concern. The long and the short of this is about making sure that consumers have the kind of information that they need to make informed decisions. So.
Thank you very much. And what I would actually like to do, a little out of the usual procedure, we have over 12 individuals online that would like to give public testimony, and rather than turn straight to committee questions, I would suggest, unless anyone on the committee has objections, that we'll open the public hearing and start hearing from the people that want to testify about it. And I'm seeing no objections, so we're going to open public testimony on House Bill 123. And we'll go online, and we'll start out with Kim Stadler. Ms. Stadler, are you available online?
Yes, I am.
If you could go ahead and present your testimony. We're asking people to keep their comments to 2 minutes, and if you can go ahead, that would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your time and for listening to my testimony. Although I realize the experience I'm going to relay may not be directly relevant to the bill before you, it does speak to transparency in healthcare. Recently, my husband went to his doctor to discuss a variety of concerns, including sleep apnea. And after examination and questioning, the doctor provided a diagnosis of sleep apnea and gave us a referral for a sleep study. Upon contacting the sleep study doctor several days later to set an appointment, I first inquired of the front desk person whether or not they were a preferred provider under my Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield plan, as I had not found them on my online search of the Premera site. She stated that they did take Premera insurance and that the website isn't updated often. I did later discover that, in fact, they are not a preferred provider, and also that Premera updates the site at least quarterly. The front desk person also informed me that they would need to produce their own diagnosis for insurance purposes, although I questioned why this would be necessary as the doctor had already provided the diagnosis. She was adamant that it was required. As instructed by my husband's doctor, I requested a home sleep study. The front desk person stated she could not guarantee one would be provided and that more than likely an in-lab study would be required. Given that this doctor is not in-network, all of this would have likely cost us a great deal. After this conversation, speaking with someone I know in the insurance industry, I did more research and contacted another sleep study doctor who was in my network for my insurance plan. I shared the information the other doctor's office had given me and was told by the front desk person for this doctor that, in fact, Premera requires a home study before an in-lab study, and that if an in-lab study is done, it's typically done not only once but twice. This entire experience left me feeling that had I not known someone in the industry to give me guidance about what questions to ask and how to navigate the system, my husband and I could have incurred significant medical expenses unnecessarily. So in summary, I'm in favor of transparency that allows me to access the information I need from my insurance company in order to understand what my costs will be for a particular medical procedure. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next on the list, I have Becky Holtberg for the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Association. She's actually listed here for questions and not to provide testimony. Ms. Holtberg, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Did you want to add anything, or are you mostly here just to answer questions that the committee may have?
I'm primarily here to answer questions. Given the opportunity, I'll just make a couple of brief comments. We support the concept of price transparency and consumer engagement in decision-making. We want to thank the bill sponsor, Representative Bonholtz, for introducing this really important topic. I think it's providing the opportunity for some very important conversations. Our healthcare payment and delivery system is complex, which makes price transparency difficult. But there's not a simple, easy solution to this problem without dismantling and rebuilding our entire system. But this is a good first step toward more transparent pricing. So I will save any other comments for later. As I had indicated, I'm available for questions if there are any of the committee, and I do want to recognize our support for price transparency and our recognition that, and thanks to Representative Bogholz for bringing this important issue forward.
Thank you very much, Ms. Holtberg, and I don't see any questions. Next is Kyle Merka. Mr. Merker, can you hear us?
Yes, thank you.
We ask you to limit your questions to, or your testimony to 2 minutes and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am grateful for the opportunity to speak today. I own two businesses here in Alaska which employ a total of approximately 60 employees.
And if you'll just state your name again so we have that on the record.
Yes, of course. Kyle Merka, M-I-R-K-A. I'm from Anchorage. I was faced at the end of 2016 with the decision on whether or not to continue our employer-sponsored healthcare plan because premiums had gone up nearly 40%. Discontinuing the plan and simply paying the ACA fine would have been substantially cheaper, but we wanted to be able to provide that benefit to our employees, so ultimately we decided to continue providing that plan as a benefit. Sadly, premiums did go up, and so employees shouldered that burden, 40% increases. If similar price increases occur at the end of this year, the choice will be very clear, and I will not be able to provide those moving forward due to the expense. I share this story to shed light on the fact that healthcare costs in Alaska are simply out of control. It is the only industry that I'm aware of that costs of service is an individual is unaware of those costs of services before the service is rendered. I've asked doctor friends and dentist friends alike how it is that they charge so much more than they do in the lower 48, and the standard answer that I've received is that it is expensive to practice in our state. And I don't claim to know their business, but I do know that in my business, products that I sell are available virtually for the same price here as they are in Seattle, Washington, or Pocatello, Idaho, or Portland, Oregon. Of course, we have added freight costs for goods, and we do have a slightly higher labor costs. But nonetheless, our prices here in Alaska are similar to those in the lower 48. Switching gears slightly, I'd also like to address some of the sentiments surrounding the RAC rates, which I've heard comments from opposition to this bill, that RAC rates, you know, don't mean much given all of the discounts that providers may give. But I think it's critical to remember that RAC rates are the starting point in which bills are settled. And that being said, the RAC rates lead to pricing that is considered in setting the 80th percentile. A rule that, but
Mr. Merker, you're at about 2 minutes. If you could go ahead and conclude.
Of course. I believe in transparency. I support House Bill 123, and I also support the removal of the 80th percentile rule. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next on the list is Perry Allard from Anchorage. Mr. Allard, can you hear us?
Yes. Actually, the name that was Perry with a T, and
Yes, I got that figured out as soon as I heard your voice. If you could state your name and your affiliation and go and proceed with your testimony.
Certainly, thank you. My name is Terry Allard, and I am a senior advisor at the Wilson Agency here in Anchorage. I'm also a charter member of the Alaska Association of Health Underwriters, and I sit on the legislative committee for that organization. I would like to testify in support of House Bill 123. I've been in the insurance and employee benefits field for over 30 years, and in my capacity at the Wilson Agency, work with many employers in Alaska statewide and their employees and their families who at one time or another, most of them are all consumers of health care. With the rising cost of health care in Alaska, it is difficult for individuals and families to cover the cost of having the coverage in the first place. In many cases, we are seeing that the employers are increasing deductibles up to $2,000 and more. That's become commonplace in Alaska. We also know from the data that we have from the United Benefit Advisors survey from 2016 in Alaska, the average cost for employee-only coverage is a little over $14,000, and that's before they ever incur a claim. So when you add those high deductibles to that, that's a significant spend. So what we do here, and part of my role is to assist employees in being good consumers of healthcare, and one of the things that we teach them to do is to ask a lot of questions. And in Alaska, there's a lot of ability to gather information on treatment facilities, treatment options, choosing physicians, asking questions about what tests are appropriate and why. But in many cases, they get to a complete roadblock when it comes time for that employee to get the cost information. So that's the missing link for them in being able to assess their options and make an informed decision.
Ms. Allard, you're at about your 2 minutes. If you could go ahead and conclude, that would be great.
Okay. So we do support passage of this. The municipality of Anchorage recently passed a similar ordinance requiring transparency. So we do feel like that this is a much-needed update to how we do business. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next is Rhonda Kidder. Ms. Kidder, if you could state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Rhonda Kidder. I am the Chief Financial Officer for the Public Education Health Trust here in Anchorage. The Public Education Health Trust is a not-for-profit health insurance provider for public education employees in Alaska. Currently, we have 17,000 Alaska residents that have health insurance through the trust. To quote the Healthcare Incentive Improvement Institute, the question of how much does it cost is so integrated so deeply into the act of buying that consumers often don't have to ask. Prices are printed on menus, stamped on tags, and posted online, among other places. But rarely do successful professionals get away with answering that question with, "It's hard to say." You'll know when you get the bill in response to consumers' inquiries about cost. As a patient, I am a consumer of healthcare experiencing a deductible and coinsurance. However, my consumer experience begins long before I'm a patient. My employer and I are purchasing a product whose cost or premium is tied back to expected cost. The theory of rack rate or undiscounted rate, chargemaster, is not paid by anyone, or that only the insurance companies know the true consumer cost is not the full story. If the rack rate, undiscounted amount, has no materiality, then why do they exist? The rack rate is important to know as they are what is driving the allowable amounts as defined by the state of Alaska's 80th percentile regulation for out-of-network providers on fully insured products. We often hear that rates are confidential, yet once the claim has incurred, I've incurred the expense and I'm obligated to pay, the rack rate does appear on my claim, on my explanation of benefits, also showing the discount or coinsurance amount. However, once again, that service has already been incurred and a legal obligation exists to pay for the services obtained. Once again, I stress, consumerism begins before the patient experience. While some states took the approach of placing the onus either on the state, creating a larger governmental administration department, or with the payers that have a limited knowledge of all providers, HB 123 correctly requires the disclosure of fees at the provider facility office. While
Ms. Kidder? You're at about your 2 minutes. If you could go ahead and conclude your testimony, that'd be great.
Thank you. While transparency for healthcare is not a silver bullet for solution of sustainability, it is one silver BB that is needed to address the rising cost. Thank you for this important piece of legislation.
Thank you very much. Next is George McKee. Mr. McKee, if you could state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
George McKee, I'm an assembly person with the Mountain Roots Association in the borough, and I am here to testify in favor of the legislation before you. I consider it to be the single most important tool that we have to begin controlling health care costs in the state of Alaska. We have mentioned here deductibles and what have you, co-pays. That comes out of the employee pocket. Everybody has testified about that up to this point. The most important thing about this bill, it will force competition.
Mr. McKee, if you could maybe back up from just like about a quarter inch, you're a little garbled, and I think you might be just a little too close to the telephone, and it's making it hard to hear.
How about that?
It's a little better, yes.
Okay. It will force competition onto the industry. The difference between the healthcare in Alaska and healthcare in the Pacific Northwest is absolutely staggering. And you can, if an employee knows that their copay is going to be $5,000, if they go in Alaska, they could go to Seattle if they could save that money. So it is a very, very important element. By the way, our health care costs here in the borough, we are self-insured. Our self-insured retention.
Mr. McKee, now our recording secretary would like you to talk a little bit slower. She's a very quick typist, but not quite that quick. So if you could slow down just a little bit.
Okay. This year, the borough is going to go over $7 million on our health care costs with a projected increase of 8% over the next 12 months. Anything you can do to mitigate that with the economic circumstances that are in the state of Alaska would be very, very helpful to our taxpayers. And if you look at the state of Alaska, they pay over $500 million in their self-insured health care plan. So any changes that would mitigate that cost would really be significant from a budgetary sense. And I will end this with one thing. The maximum penalty of $2,500 really isn't going to get it. The health care providers really oppose this bill, and a large health care provider will simply write a check for $2,500 and do nothing at all. And that's the only thing he doesn't have to worry.
All right, Mr. McKee, you have now come up with about your 2 minutes of testimony. If you could go ahead and conclude, that would be great.
So that's fine. Just the penalty, I think, is insignificant and sufficient.
Thank you very much. Next online we have John Moosey. Mr. Moosey, if you could state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mr. Clayman and the House Judiciary Committee. My name is John Moosey. I'm a Mat-Su Borough Manager, and we are very much in support of Representative Sponsholes' legislation, House Bill 123. The Mat-Muska Sioux City Borough has over 300 employees and families we provide health insurance to. This would provide a great incentive for us to require our employees to make good health care decisions. This puts the power back into the common person where they can make good financial decisions. Also believe this will drive up competition, which will be better for health care. And one of the things that Assemblymember McKee also alluded to is we have people who are encouraged to leave the state of Alaska, leave the United States, because they can significantly change and reduce their health insurance costs. With the added competition, we can keep our people here, and that would be better for our whole health care industry. So thank you very much. Full support of this. Thank you, Representative Sponsholes, for sponsoring this.
Thank you very much. Next, we have T.J. Allenan. And if I'm not sure whether that's a Mr. or Ms. Allenan, but if you could state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman. It is a Mr. I'm T.J. Allenan. I'm the Assistant Vice President for Human Resources at Denali Federal Credit Union. Denali has 325 employees currently residing in Alaska and is currently the third largest credit union in the state. Calling in today on behalf of our organization and myself in support of HB 123, the escalation in cost of health care is one of the greatest challenges that our organization and many organizations in Alaska are currently facing. In the spirit of a free market, it's important to understand that buyers and sellers engage in some degree of communication in determining services and goods and pricing. Unfortunately, this doesn't occur in the healthcare industry, and ultimately, it's impacting the pocketbooks of consumers and employers. We believe that market transparency and having information available will assist our employees and all Alaskans in becoming better consumers of healthcare and hopefully driving the cost down. Now, as Terry Allard indicated, there is an emphasis on higher deductible health plans in Alaska. Many organizations have implemented them as a way to, shift costs between employers and employees. It's important to understand that these individuals are responsible for higher amounts at the front end of health care services and meeting their deductibles. In our organization, 40% of our employees have high deductible health plans. These are individuals that have to incur the first $2,600 in health care expenses annually. When it really comes down to it, there's no real way for them to really be good consumers, because comparing costs between providers and facilities is nearly impossible. So, and again, the only losers in the current proposition are employees and Alaskans. So, in light of the health care crisis that all Alaskans are currently facing, we believe it is necessary for the legislature to pass HB 123 to help our employees and member and sponsor groups manage their health care better. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Allen. And next is Tom Westcott. Mr. Westcott, if you could state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Tom Westcott, President of the Alaska Professional Firefighters. I'm calling in today to support House Bill 123. For over a decade, I've worked on health care issues as an elected union official. I understand it's complex. House Bill 123 is an important first step in tackling the out-of-control health care costs. Health care consumers in Alaska are affected by our geographic isolation and also by the lack of information. In order to act as rational consumers, one must be armed with information. Obtaining price information for medical procedures is extremely hard and sometimes not even available. Lacking pricing information prevents Alaskans from being the rational consumers we'd all like them to be. Many of the firefighters in Alaska are in a health care trust with our brothers and sisters in Washington State. Our eyes have been opened to the price differences charged in both areas. We currently pay 30% more for our plan that's identical to Washington. And this last year, we spent nearly $1 million more than we put in. And this is not related to usage. We can find in Alaska, oftentimes, common procedures can be 3, 4, 5, 6 times what they are in Washington State. Providing transparency will help consumers act rationally, and it can be done. I'd encourage everyone to look at the Oklahoma Surgery Center as a place that provides pricing for all procedures for walking in the door and walking out the door. It can be done, and this is a good first step. We all share in the burden of health care costs. The state has a real vested interest in bringing the cost of health care down. I commend Representative Sponholz for bringing this issue forward. And again, the Alaska Professional Firefighters are in support of House Bill 123.
Thank you very much. I believe, Mr. Westcott, that Representative Kreis Tompkins has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have questions for previous testifiers, if we can circle back to them at another time, particularly the health underwriters and OSHNA. But
if they're still online, we can go back to them after you finish asking Mr. Westcott. I'm not certain how many of them stay on the line after we finish their testimony or not, but go ahead, Representative Kreis Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Westcott, could you speak offhand, if you can recall the information of what the price spread for certain procedures or treatments is between facilities in Alaska and equivalent facilities in Washington or elsewhere in the lower 48?
Yes, through the chair. Off the top of my head, I think it was Alaska Public Media that a few years ago ran an article about an individual who fell on flat top and required shoulder surgery. And he was quoted roughly, I think, $50,000 or $60,000 up here and had it done for $14,000 at the University of Washington down in the Seattle area. I know in our trust we've seen a breast cancer procedure, same codes, $60,000 in Alaska and $23,000 in Washington State. These are just some of the examples. We're gathering that data. But, you know, it can be anywhere from twice as expensive to somewhere 1,000 times more. And it's, you know, we as a group would love to spend our money in the state of Alaska and, you know, keep it here at home, but it's just getting harder and harder with the prices that are being charged for certain procedures. And we're not talking, you know, we're talking shoulder surgery, we're talking ACL repairs. A lot of the orthopedic injuries that happen to affect firefighters, police officers, I'm sure construction work, people in physical career fields, and also just Alaskans who like to enjoy the outdoors. And, you know, you may end up slipping on the ice. So, but those are just off the top of my head. Those are a few that I'm familiar with.
Follow up,
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Westcott. I would be very interested in firm, concrete numbers that your trust has received from providers in Anchorage, and equivalent quotes from providers in the lower 48 for certain procedures or treatments or codes, and putting that on the record to the extent that you're able and are comfortable. Is that something that you think you could do?
Through the chair, we are working on that. We have to obviously respect the privacy, but the individuals who manage the trust are working on gathering that data, and we were trying to lay out, you know, specific, this is what an ACL cost in Fairbanks, and this is what an ACL cost in Seattle and or Spokane or one of the other areas. And the preliminary, which I mentioned, the breast cancer procedure, some of them are pretty staggering.
And Representative Christ Tompkins, I see the bill sponsor, Representative Sponholz, I think can add to this discussion. Representative Sponholz.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, there actually is a pretty interesting document that was put together. It's the Alaska Workers' Compensation Fee Schedule Comparative Survey that was put together by the Department of Labor. It's dated 2013, and it has price comparisons for certain procedures in the state of Alaska, Medicare schedules, Washington State, Oregon, Idaho, and then the Alaska Median Healthcare Allowance price, and it's startling. So just starting at the very top of the document, the first procedure listed is an arthroscopy knee with meniscus repair. The workman's compensation fee schedule is $5,158.02. The Alaska median healthcare allowance for that same procedure is $5,170. In Washington, the workman's comp fee schedule for that is $912.56. I'd be happy to share this document with the entire committee. It's, I think, a wonderful example of the price comparisons, and this work has already been done by the state.
Yeah, thank you. I've actually reviewed that document, and part of what I'm interested in is, I mean, I think it would be great to have the Department of Labor speak to the origin of the data that they gathered and how they, for instance, cluster and bundle CPT codes to constitute a particular treatment or procedure, and standardize that in an apples-to-apples manner. I mean, I'd also be interested in Mr. Westcott's data as sort of a more non-public sector actor, but you know, in either direction, I think this is really relevant information and foundational to understand the issue.
Let's do this, because I agree that the information you're talking about is actually very important, but we also actually have several people that still would like to testify, and so I think that if the follow-up you had with the others is similar kind of detailed data questions, I think we'd be better off. We have their contact information. Let's get through the public testimony. And then if we still have time, we can go back to those folks. But I want to give the people that are online that want to testify an opportunity to testify. Mr. Westcott, if you can stick around until the end of our hearing at 3, we may have more questions. And Representative Christ Tompkins, I know if you can let me know the people you'd like to have available, I'll let them know after the next person. Next on the line is Blanche Shepherd. Ms. Shepherd, if you can identify yourself and any affiliation you may have, and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Blanche Shepherd. I work at North Rim Benefits Group. I am also a member of AHU, the Alaska Association of Health Underwriters. So I am calling to testify in support of HB 123.
And if you could clarify, are you speaking on your own behalf or on the organization that you work for?
I'm speaking on my own behalf.
Thank you.
Thank you. So almost a year ago, on April 2nd, I had a baby. I was 28 years old, and this was the first time I had a major medical occurrence in which I was entirely financially responsible. Now that I'm working in insurance, I can look at my EOBs and dissect them. I can question why something wasn't applied to my deductible or my out-of-pocket max. I have an in. Most Alaskans don't have that in. I'm working in insurance, and I've looked at enough EOBs to know that the going rate of some procedures, such as epidurals in Anchorage. But people who don't work in the health industry don't have that knowledge. But if we want to encourage patients to become the consumers they are in every other industry, we have to require that the health industry support consumer-driven healthcare by displaying those prices, those pricing structures openly. Once our consumers begin to question, they also begin to self-advocate to educate themselves on their healthcare and concerns they have with healthcare pricing. Pricing transparency does not hurt any industry in Alaska. It behooves doctors to have educated and health-driven patients. It behooves patients to be educated on where they can obtain the best care at the most cost-effective prices. It behooves insurance companies to work with doctors to negotiate patient-driven prices and therefore reduce claims costs. Some of our major insurers have travel programs that reimburse patients who travel out of state for many procedures because taking into account the price of travel to the lower 48, the procedures are still significantly cheaper than here in Alaska. We need to encourage physicians to rise to a challenge of keeping those patients here in the state of Alaska, supporting the Alaskan economy. I don't just work in the insurance industry. I am an active participant in the healthcare system.
Ms. Shepard, if you could go ahead, your 2 minutes is, you've used up 2 minutes. If you could go ahead and conclude, that'd be great.
Sure. I just want to give my support of the bill and say that if we can educate our population and make choices that are healthy for their bottom line and for their personal health, we will all succeed.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Holtberg and Ms. Allard, we may get back to you before we wind up today if you can continue to stand by. Next online we have Jeff Ramph. Mr. Ramph, if you could state your name and your affiliation that you have.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Ramph. I'm a consultant broker in the health insurance business. I've been in the business for 30 years. I'm here on behalf of the Alaskans for Sustainable Healthcare Coalition. Here to testify on behalf of House Bill 123. And as a longtime veteran in the industry, I am compelled to testify to express how important healthcare transparency is. Our healthcare system is very unique amongst the advanced industrial countries. It would be considered non-uniform in the world, even though the ACA attempted to make the playing field even. We are still very much a free market system, hence the reason why we need transparency like any other industry. Most healthcare in this country, even though it's publicly financed, is still delivered privately. And why is this important? It's important in Alaska, not just because we have the most expensive healthcare in the U.S., it's because we don't know why it's expensive. One way to address it is to first understand where the cost of healthcare is coming from. It begins at the individual level. Despite what you may have heard from others in the past, the cost of our insurance premiums is a direct result of underlying cost of healthcare. However, a large percentage of our citizens don't understand this, and they only see their health insurance premiums rising every year. I'm here to express the importance of knowing what the cost is, knowing what my out-of-pocket costs are going to be before the procedure is done seems very logical to me. I'm fortunate enough to have a good health insurance plan, albeit it's a high-deductible health plan with health savings account, where I'm required to pay roughly the first $5,000 out-of-pocket before my plan kicks into gear. Doesn't seem logical that I have the knowledge of what that $5,000 going towards. I would want to know what that is and any other expenses that it might apply to in my policy. And if there's potential cost that could be billed to me after my insurance reimburses the provider, I would definitely want to know this before the procedure is performed.
Mr. Ramp, you're at about 2 minutes. If you could go ahead and conclude, that'd be great.
HB 123 is just one step in the right direction in accomplishing this. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee, and especially Representative Sponholz for sponsoring this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next on the list is Jason Hipser. Mr. Hipser, if you could state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, this is Jason Hipster. I own a small business in Alaska. I have professional licensing in the state of Alaska, but I'm here on behalf of myself and my family. I'm here to support House Bill 123. The healthcare costs in our state are quite extreme, and I've traveled, lived other places, used other healthcare systems, and I really have received top-notch service in other countries for a much lower price. The things I see going on here, there's not a lot that we can control today. It's a very complicated system, but giving us transparency and giving us the ability to see what we're spending our money on is vital for, I guess, the free market to function the way that it's designed in this country. And thank you for your time and your consideration of this bill. I think it's an important bill to Alaskans in general.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The next person I have that wishes to testify is actually a person here in the room, Denise Daniello. Ms. Daniello, if you could come forward, and I think Representative, they'll make room for you at the table. Please state your name and your affiliation and proceed.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, committee members, Chair Klayman. My name is Denise Daniello, and I serve as the Executive Director for the Alaska Commission on Aging. The commission is a governor-appointed board within the Department of Health and Social Services that plans services for seniors. We educate Alaskans about senior issues, and we make recommendations directly to the legislature and to the governor regarding budget and policy items affecting seniors. And on behalf of the commission, I'm here today to express our support for CSHB 123. Seniors, more than any other age group, are consumers of health care. And many seniors live on fixed incomes. It's very important to them to have information about how much health care services cost them so that they can make informed decisions and to have meaningful conversations with their doctors and other primary care providers. They have expressed this to us during community forums held at senior centers that we conducted regarding the Medicaid redesign efforts for the Department of Health and Social Services. And so I just want to reinforce our support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Ledoux has a follow-up question.
So aren't seniors covered by Medicare so that they wouldn't be paying the costs of their health care?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, thank you for that question. So a couple things. People who are between the ages, seniors, it's the age for being a senior is kind of a relative term. It depends on who you talk to. If you talk to Social Security, it could be 67. If you talk to Medicare, it's 65. If you talk to HUD, it's age 50. If you talk to the Administration on Community Living, it's age 60. So older adults we consider people ages 55 to 64, they pay for their own health care. People aged 65 years and older are, for the most part, covered by Medicare, but not everybody. So there are some people who have not contributed to Medicare and so would be responsible for paying their health care costs.
Follow-up, Representative Ledoux.
That's kind of it. Who wouldn't have been contributing to Medicare?
People who have, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, people who have lived a subsistence lifestyle, people who have been full-time, who have been out of the work world for a variety of reasons. Maybe they were a parent or a caregiver and didn't participate in the workforce and so didn't contribute to Medicare.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. We also have Heidi Langdorfer is here for questions or online, and Jill Lewis is in the room, Deputy Director of Division of Public Health, available for questions. I will not close public testimony. I know Representative Christ Tompkins, I'll give Ms. Holtberger, are you still on the line?
Yes.
Representative Christ Tompkins, I think, has a question. Others may have a question, but Representative Christ Tompkins, go ahead with your questions for Ms. Hultberg.
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Chair, and I realize we have limited time, and I hope there's an opportunity to continue this dialogue. Becky, I was wondering, I mean, this bill specifies the top procedure codes, and when we're talking about CPT codes, sometimes they can be incredibly myopic, so much so that my question is, do you have a sense of, in your average hospital, your average community or regional hospital that offers a full spectrum of services, what some examples of the top 25 procedure codes would be? And this might be a question for the sponsor as well, but I wanted to ask Becky first, given her her affiliation representing hospitals.
Ms. Hultberg, go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, I don't have a specific example, but I can give you an idea of some of the things we think will very likely be near the top of the list. The way the bill is written right now, it is the top 50 procedures by volume, essentially. So we anticipate that on that list, we'll see a lot of things like lab, so CPT codes for blood draws. We'll probably see some things like chest x-rays, procedures that are, or services that are quite common for a large number of patients. Those are likely the things that will be at the very top of the list. Now, in talking to some of the CFOs, they do think there will be quite a number of lab charges on the list. Now, what an example of a top 50 list is, I don't know. We haven't quite pulled an exact list from a facility. There may be things like surgeries on the list, but we won't know until we really run that data.
And Mr. Chair, could I ask
Representative Christ Tompkins?
Same question of the sponsor, if you have a sense of what those codes might be, or even a list that has come from a specific provider.
Do we have Dr.
Questions? Okay. So the reason that we actually chose CPT codes was actually at the recommendation of ASHNA, that we had looked at sort of trying to find a broader bucket list that sort of could be a little bit, you know, item that could be a little bit more inclusive, so that, say, when you were looking at the price of a surgery, it included all of the labs and the x-rays and anything else that you might get in there. But the truth is that there isn't any one system that's already been designed out there to do that. CPT code is the code of choice that is used, and the surgery, for example, that I described to you earlier, that particular Department of Labor report is actually defined by CPT code. If you look at it again, now that we've had this conversation, you'll notice that the second column from the left is CPT code. And we have actually an example that came from an eye doctor in town. Can you? An ophthalmologist, actually. He ran a list for us, and he actually has one that he gives to his front desk staff that do the billing. And so it includes some kind of funny things, which is why we put some language in the bill. We actually haven't even gotten to the sectional, so we've moved into questions before we've gotten to sectional, so you may be missing out from some key pieces of information we would have described. But it starts with removal of superficial conj foreign body. That's removing something from the body, right? Removal embedded foreign body conj. Removal foreign body cornea. Repair conjunctival laceration, which is the reason that, and these are the actual billing codes that they use, and that's the reason that in the bill we actually put a specific piece of language that says that it needs to be written in common language that the layperson can understand, because I obviously don't know what conjunctival means. Not having planned to talk about it, I didn't look it up before this conversation, and, you know, so that's one of the pieces that we've asked for. And one of the reasons, actually, that we asked to keep the list fairly brief was that is one level of added work that we're asking doctors and or healthcare facilities to provide. I expect over time that will become sort of the norm that, you know, that becomes a part of the database, is the normal description that lay people
will need. The idea for this bill actually came to me from a constituent who came to a coffee. I have monthly coffees at a local restaurant in my district, and she said, you know, I got some healthcare in Florida, and when I walked into the clinic there was a price list on the wall, and I thought that was so awesome. And she felt really empowered as a consumer and shared that idea with me. So I think that as we evolve, as the healthcare profession continues to evolve, we'll add that piece into the database in the future.
And did you have any? Your next on your list was Terry Allard. Or did you finish your question with Ms. Holberg?
Yeah, I think that's helpful. Maybe a quick comment, maybe defer to Representative Ledoux or however. I mean, that makes sense, and I'll have to go back and look at that workers' comp spreadsheet, because, I mean, certainly if you're having orthopedic knee surgery, there's going to be a bevy of CPT codes. It's not just one CPT code. And so, I mean, how you skin that cat, I think those details are pretty important. So, I think it'll be helpful to interrogate that, because, I mean, ultimately the outcome we want is that there's going to be a list of information on the lobby wall that's going to be helpful and germane to the consumer. Mm-hmm. And I spoke with someone in the insurance part of the healthcare community who actually pulled the top 10 CPT codes for a very large self-insurance entity. Mm-hmm. And I'll share this with you, Representative Swanholz, but it was actually, they were so arcane that
They
didn't seem useful.
Right, which is why actually we included that language in the bill. And perhaps before we go too much further, we should actually go through the bill, because we haven't had that discussion yet. And so we're having a discussion about what's in the bill when we haven't agreed on what's in the bill yet.
Well, let's do this. I know Representative Ledoux had a comment. I want to hear from Representative Ledoux, and then I'll see where we're going next. Go ahead.
Well, I actually have a question for the bill sponsor. So I follow how somebody, a patient, can use this if they don't have any insurance. And so the doctors post, I think they call it the rack rate. But how do you use it? And why would you even use it if you're covered by insurance? And I suppose one of the reasons you might use it is if something's going to, you're trying to figure out how much of a deductible or a copay you're going to have to pay. But I'm just wondering how somebody who is covered by insurance, how they are going to use the rack rate information.
Sure. And that's a very good question. And this is a question that we spent a lot of time on in working out this bill, trying to determine what price point we would use. In talking with providers and experts in the healthcare field, there are, you know, often maybe as many as 11 different prices that any one provider may have for one given service. And so what we wanted to try to do was sort of to balance access to information with clarity of information, and sometimes more information is not better if it's so overwhelming that you can't dissect that information. And frankly, looking at a spreadsheet of 11 different prices for 100 services, you know, nobody's going to actually look at that beyond researchers, and that there's some merit to that, but it's not terribly useful to a consumer. And so we felt the need to sort of settle in to focus in on one particular rate. And since the undiscounted price, or the rack rate, or it's also called the charge master by hospitals, I've learned, that rate is the rate on which all other rates are developed. That was the reason that we decided to opt in there, because the rates do vary so much. But because that rate is so different from what so many people, not all, but so many people pay, we wanted to be clear that that this is not the price that most people will be paying, and that's why there's the disclaimer at the bottom. But that is very difficult. Do you pick the average price that is paid for that service? Well, that is going to vary depending on, for each provider, depending on what kind of customer type they have that year. If they had a lot of Medicare patients over that last year, that price is going to be artificially low for somebody who's paying with a private insurance company. And if you're, you know, if you a healthcare provider takes insurance but isn't in the preferred provider network, once again, your rate is going to be significantly higher than that. So we felt the need to start with some sort of rational basis that for all providers would be exactly the same, since I we felt that there was a fairness issue and a transparency issue with all of the other prices.
Let me do this before you do the follow-up. I just want to know, we're coming up on 3 o'clock. We can certainly go for 15 more minutes if the committee wants to stay. I'm happy to stay. I would note, though, that we have gone through everyone in public testimony. I know that both Ms. Holtberg and Ms. Allard are folks that are involved in this industry, and we can certainly have them back for invited testimony. And so my general thought is I will close the public testimony now, and if everyone wants to stay, we'll stay for 15 minutes and continue the discussion and perhaps even get a section analysis, as the sponsor has been suggesting. anybody have problems with staying the extra 15 minutes?
Can we check our calendars first?
Absolutely. I'm going to close the public hearing now while we check our calendars. So the public hearing is closed. Well, is there anyone else in the room that wants to be heard? Hearing and seeing no one. The public testimony is closed. All right. Let's just take one moment.
I'm fine for 15 minutes.
Okay. So we'll stay for 15 minutes. And Representative Ledoux, you had a follow-up question for the bill sponsor.
So I totally understand why you've done it this way, but I'm kind of trying to figure out, I mean, how many, I probably have more than one question, it's like a line of things here. I mean, how many uninsured people are there? Because the way that the bill reads now, I'm not sure whether it does anything for the insured person.
So, you know, I can't answer off the top of my head how many uninsured people there are within the state of Alaska. It is in the thousands range. But for the insured person, I'll just speak as somebody who's double insured. Just because you're insured doesn't mean that you don't care about the cost of health care. And I am the kind of patient who asks before any test is done and before a prescription is offered to me what something costs, because I want to make sure that there's a, you know, that there's a high return on investment for whatever cost, you know, service that's being offered. And there has been times when I have declined services based on what I felt was a low return on investment for a high cost. And I, you know, I'll give you an example where there's this disconnect between the consumer's out-of-pocket costs and what something actually costs. I saw a provider about 2 years ago for you know, a moderate healthcare issue that that was bothering me. There was, you know, I went in. It was a new provider that I didn't have an existing relationship with, so we didn't know each other very well yet. She didn't know that I was, you know, a cost hawk when it comes to healthcare, and she was very concerned about making sure that I didn't have to pay out of pocket for my medicine. And so she prescribed a medicine to me which ended up costing hundreds of dollars for a prescription medicine for which there was an over-the-counter option that would have cost me less than $20. And me, being the cost hawk that I am, I care what the total cost of healthcare is, even if my out-of-pocket was lower. And that's when, you know, after that personal, that individual experience, that's when I started asking, is that the right drug for me? Because her primary goal was to make sure that my out-of-pocket cost was absolute minimum, when in fact it actually was about 10 times higher in cost, in overall cost. The medicine was like $250 roughly, whereas I could have just paid $15 for an over-the-counter medicine that I would have happily done. And so, I mean, I think that's an example of how somebody might care about healthcare costs that they don't have to pay personally.
Just follow up there. I think your attitude, obviously, Representative Sponholz, is quite laudable. I'm not positive whether or not your attitude would be the general attitude. But even assuming that it were, I'm still not sure how the insured patient who is a cost hawk would be able to figure out anything the way this bill is written using the rack rates. That's my...
Sure. So there's a couple of different sort of pieces. One thing that I said in my introductory remarks is that I'm not proposing to solve all healthcare cost issues with this bill. This bill was designed to be one small piece of a large, a large effort. I'm calling it the first mile in a marathon. You've run distances. You know what that means. That means that I'm in for a slog for a very, very long time, because the first mile is the first 10 minutes of what is a 4.5 hour torture,
For you, 4.5 hours. For me, twice the time.
So this is really just one piece of an overall thing. This is not designed to solve any problems. There are ways that we could come up with legislation which would be far more complex to implement, that would give individuals, individual quotes. I've not chosen to take that route. I chose to aim for simplicity and getting more information out there. However, one of the things that is really important to me is to make sure that having more information being out in the public domain doesn't get in the way of people actually pursuing health care or finding out what their actual costs will be. And so we made sure that there's a disclaimer, that a disclaimer is allowed to be on this publication of prices, like any menu where there's disclaimers, where, if you're looking at a menu at a restaurant, there's things that say that there's, what's got shellfish and what's gluten-free or whatever, sort of the same thing. And we're not limiting it, so providers can say what it is that they want to say, but clarifying that the rack rate, the undiscounted rate, or the charge master rate isn't necessarily the price that they will pay. But since it is the rate on which all other rates are built, I feel it's a fairly rational place to start.
Thank you.
All right. I don't see questions, and so at the suggestion of the bill sponsor, why don't you go through with your sectional analysis?
All right. Thank you. And I will pass the mic over to Bernice Nesbitt.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Bernice Nesbitt, and I will be going over the sections with you. There are only three sections, one of which is it's where all of the work is actually happening. So in section one, it's been expanded to include that the Department of Health and Social Services collects health information and price information. And from here on out, if I refer to the department, it means the Department of Health and Social Services. Section 2, it states that healthcare providers and facilities will...
Hold on just a second.
Sure.
Representative Ledoux has a question.
I'm just a little bit confused here. I don't know whether we're on the CS or we're on the original bill.
We're on the CS, which I think is...
It's version I.
Version I.
Okay, thank you.
So I believe the CS was adopted in the prior committee, which is why we don't have to adopt the CS.
So section 1 is where the department is expanding to include healthcare services and price information. Section 2 states that healthcare providers and facilities will compile a list of their most common procedures, 25 for providers and 50 for facilities, along with the undiscounted price for each of these procedures. So subsection C states that this information will be compiled annually, and then this information will be posted in the reception area or on the website if they have one. And then subsection D states that with the compiled information, the healthcare provider or facility will put a disclaimer stating that the price listed will be higher or lower. Subsection E again states that this information will be compiled annually, and then the department will compile this information and post the name of the facility and the address. Subsection F on page 3 states that if the healthcare provider cannot provide their 25 most common procedures or their 50 most common procedures, they have to list all of their procedures that are done in the facility. And then subsection G is where the civil penalties happen. If a healthcare facility or provider does not compile the list and turn it in to the department by March 31st, they will incur a $50 fee charge up to $2,500. And then subsection H goes through several definitions. And then on page 4, section 3, this states the effective date of January 1st, 2018. And if you have any other questions about the bill, I'd be happy to answer or clarify anything that seems confusing.
I see no questions on that. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. And I may have a question for Health and Human Services on CPT codes and sort of overall procedure costs. So I was just looking at the top 10 CPT codes that were pulled for a particular, effectively, private insurer. And it's, 0300 laboratory general classification, 0301 laboratory chemistry, similar to what you're saying. And the plain English description is great as specified in the bill. That's not actually quite what I guess I'm getting at or sort of wanting to interrogate, which is when we look at the workers' comp data for this is how much it costs to get an arthroscopic knee surgery or what Mr. Westcott was testifying to, saying, this is the breast cancer procedure that our members were trying to get quotes on. That's really helpful because that is the bulk of what people pay. I mean, those very sort of high-priced CPT codes that can cost thousands or tens of thousands of dollars. I guess it's occurring to me that for many providers, certainly non-specialty providers that have a broad spectrum of services that they provide, the 25 or 50 or even 100 most common CPT codes they provide you could provide plain English descriptions that say what they are. It's a blood draw or it's chiropractic manipulation, 98941. But these are perhaps the CPT codes that actually don't constitute the real price and cost of healthcare. That people might be particularly interested in. And I guess if you have any comment on that, I mean, maybe with an ophthalmologist, that isn't so much the case because it's a specialty provider. And so the most common procedures they provide end up being the very expensive sort of meat of what is charged. But for general service providers, if there's maybe an issue with it being these sort of chicken peck procedures that will dominate this list, even though what people might be interested in is how much an MRI costs, but an MRI might not be and make the top list.
Sure. So you've asked about three questions in there. We settled on the CPT code. This was not the first, wasn't the first definition that we came up with. We had a different definition originally, and then upon advice of ASHNA and other professionals in the field, we settled on CPT code because it is the standard that is already used within the field, and we felt like in order to make this practical and practicable for people to proceed forward with in a simple way. We really want this to be simple to implement and not creating a new bureaucracy. We philosophically chose simplicity as a theme in how we approach this because we want this to be simple for sole practitioners to implement because we're not just talking about hospitals, we're also talking about country docs in Talkeetna and in smaller communities, and so we wanted this to be very practical. And so when Ms. Holtberg and others in the field said a CPT code is the code that we use really for everything, we thought, okay, well then we settled there, and that was a change. The reason that it's there's an easy comparison from provider to provider when you use the code that is already being used, practically speaking, within the field. With regard to the issue of whether or not you might have sort of small individual procedures listed that could take up the bulk of the prices offered. It's true that most every general practitioner will have flu shot in their list, right? Because that's going to be one of the more common things that they're going to do. They may also have blood draw be one of the most common things that they do. One of the And so it's very, very likely that there will be a bit of a range of that will include those sorts of things. And, you know, I'm open to the possibility that we might even want to include more services in order to make sure that we're getting to the meat of the issue. But there will be sort of a range for every provider that includes the things that they most commonly provide. What we didn't want to do was require providers to list everything because, as I mentioned earlier, there are over 10,000 Medicaid codes for healthcare services, and that's not a reasonable expectation. Thirdly, one of the challenges that we run into, and you're sort of addressing it when you're talking about the need to know what the prices are for a total service. You know, I recently had just a small procedure done, and I had a little cyst that was removed from my wrist recently. And in order to get the total cost for that, and I asked for an estimate in advance because once we've already discussed the fact that I'm a budget hawk when it comes to healthcare costs, we had to get quotes from various different institutions. What I am not promising and not trying to deliver through this particular piece of legislation a comprehensive estimate for any one service, because what we've asked for are services by facility or provider. And in the case of my surgery, I had a surgeon, there was an anesthetologist, and there was a surgery center. There was also labs. In the particular case of this surgery, most of those things were all within one practitioner, but in other cases, if you're talking about an independent practitioner that's not a part of a large practice, then you know you might get the estimate for the cyst removal from the doctor, and that would be one of their prices, and then you would get your labs from a different place, and you'd have the anesthetologist elsewhere. So this is not about providing individual estimates. An individual estimate bill would be more along the lines of the ordinance that was recently passed in. That was passed in Anchorage. This particular one is more about looking sort of at the meta level of healthcare costs.
So let me do this because we're due to stop at 3:15. I had both Representative Fansler and Representative Eastman on my list, but we can't do that in 1 minute. So what we're going to do is we're going to hold House Bill 123 at this time. I would certainly encourage everyone to communicate with Representative Sponholt's office to get more information. We will be hearing the bill again and probably next week. So keep your questions. I'm not trying to cut off questions, just trying to keep us on schedule. So we will adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is scheduled for Monday the 27th at 1 p.m. On Monday, we will again hear House Bill 123, Disclosure of Healthcare Costs. And if we don't get through with it on Monday, we will certainly continue at a further date. My initial intention had been to move House Bill 123 out of committee. And I would just note, we usually have a deadline at 5 on Friday to get amendments in. I'm realistic enough to know that ain't happening. If you have some inclination to want to offer amendments to the bill, please let my office know that you're interested in amending it as opposed to gaining more information. If you have some inclination towards an amendment, let us know, and then we'll try to adapt that into kind of how we go forward. But again, there's a lot of interest, and so it may not be realistic to complete our work on this on Monday, but that's a possibility that, depending on where we are, we may try to move it on Monday. We will also be taking up amendments to House Bill 42 on Monday. If committee members have amendments to House Bill 42, please submit them to my office by 5 p.m. this evening to allow enough time to distribute before Monday's meeting. I will note that I have received amendments from Representative Eastman, Representative Kopp, and my office has prepared some amendments, and it is my intention on Monday to address all those amendments and move the bill out of committee. That's House Bill 42 on Monday. And so with that, we're going to stand adjourned at 5:16 p.m.